Welcome to Our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. I'm John Strickland. This is a podcast where we gaze into the crystal ball and look at what the future may hold for the airline business. I know from personal experience that it's never been an industry for the faint-hearted. There's always plenty of things to throw it off course, from wars and geopolitical upheavals to economic crises and natural disasters. And that's even before we factor in the massive challenge of sustainability. So with all these factors in mind, where might the industry be in 10 or 20 years from now? And what factors are going to shape its trajectory? Well, who better to answer these questions than those leading the industry, tapping into their wide experience and bringing their thinking, most importantly, to our podcast. We've already spoken on previous editions to a diverse group of leaders from different parts of the sector. So today, we're going to step back a little and take a more of a bird's eye view from an economist, ideally placed to comment on what turbulent environment we might encounter in the decades ahead. And I think all the more interesting today because our guest actually comes from outside the sector and is a relative newcomer to aviation. So let me introduce Marie Owens-Thompson, Senior Vice President, Sustainability and Chief Economist at IATA. IATA, of course, being the global airline trade body. She actually joined IATA at the start of 2022 after holding leading positions in the financial sector and earlier in her career at IKEA. So welcome to Our Future Skies, Marie.
I am thrilled to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Well, delighted to have you. But I gave a little bit of a flavour to your background and mentioned you're relatively fresh to the industry. So just if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about yourself, that background you came from, a very significant financial career predominantly.
Yeah, so I self-identify as Swedish, and that might explain the stint at IKEA. And I'm still very fond of flat packages, and indeed, then I continued as an economist and worked for banks for, really the vast majority of my career. And given that I'm 62 now, that was some good 20 years in banking. And then I came to the point where that was just sort of no longer really fitting with my view of how I thought I should spend my remaining productive years. And I went looking for a new opportunity. And lo and behold, this happened. And of course, like every woman, I first saw the ad and didn't apply for chief economist at IATA because I thought, oh, great job, but pity, I don't know anything about aviation. And then whatever it was, 3-4 months later, I saw that the ad was still up. And then I thought, okay, they're obviously struggling, so I can apply now. And here we are. So that was absolutely amazing.
Fantastic. I mean, you mentioned about the idea that being a woman was a factor in your thinking. And, I've asked some other interviewees on this series. We've had two or three leaders of airlines who themselves are women who've broken through, I suppose, the glass ceiling, if it's fair to say that. Do you think that is still a challenge that's got to be given full attention and wrestled with in aviation? I mean, IATA itself has taken some particular initiatives, of course, with this 25 by 25 initiative to employ at least 25% women in senior positions and across the business.
Yes, absolutely. That is definitely our commitment. And I think that's a great initiative. But obviously, clearly, it's not enough. And yeah, I do clearly think that this is a problem, not only in our industry, but in every industry. And I think that what we need to solve this problem is more men hiring more women, and then problem solved. So definitely, all credit goes to Willy Walsh, who had, the audacity to take such a decision. And I am every day grateful.
Fantastic. And coming to aviation, I mean, to me, I've had my entire career in aviation. I don't know any other world, but I would say, looking back to where you came from, primarily the financial community, that would seem to be an industry of high returns, high margins, high powered finance, employing economic parameters to fuel its move forward. While aviation, in all the time I've been in the industry, it's been low margin, fragile, volatile, cyclical, all those things. Did you look at that and did that not in any way put you off? And has it indeed proved to be what you found?
Yeah, no, totally not off-putting, and in many ways motivating, I would say, because as an economist, I really believe that, I don't mean to oversimplify, but economic development has a very intimate connection with the improvements in transportation and the reduction in transportation costs. So all forms of connectivity, you could say, and clearly not only aviation, but I would say aviation is a necessary but not sufficient. That's a phrase we like to use in economics. So aviation is a necessary but not sufficient condition for economic development. And I think I even said in my interviews, that I can more easily imagine a future without banks than I can imagine a future without airlines. And maybe that was the thing that clinched the
And that's perhaps a good future, actually,
deal.
probably. I think you know what most people would prefer.
Indeed.
We've just talked about you coming to the aviation sector and IATA's role as a global trade body for the sector. Many listeners will be in the industry and know a lot about IATA, others may not. So, would you just like to give us a little resume, if you like, of what IATA does, what are its key areas of focus, and how that looks to be delivering results for the future?
Absolutely. So IATA grew up sort of hand in hand with ICAO, our UN sister organization for civil aviation. And ICAO then have the UN member states as members. And we have the airlines as members. And we have about 330 airlines as members all over the world. And all of these companies, they represent about 85% of global traffic. So these organizations have now then IATA and ICAO been active for 80 and 79 years, respectively, and therefore have always been the standard-setting bodies and made sure, that we can now fly as safely as we can. Another thing that IATA does that you might not know is that we actually clear all the payments in the system. So you buy a ticket from your travel agent, maybe, and it involves perhaps two airlines. And then the ticket money goes through IATA, which helps airlines, not overpay for those services when we can do it for them. And many other such solutions also are provided by IATA. So standard setting, best practices, things that we can do together in order to be more efficient and save money. That's pretty much what we do, on top of whatever advocacy our airlines want us to pursue as well.
Well, thanks for that explanation, Marie. I'm sure that's going to enlighten those in the audience who didn't know about IATA already. Let's take some of your wide experience, Marie, and look at some of the big ticket issues that are going to affect the industry in the years ahead. And you've already published a lot of material in IATA and presented on the diversity of facts which are influencing the industry now and will continue to do so. Give us some flavors that we should be thinking about, how they may impact the industry in the decades ahead.
Right. So my head first goes to sustainability and the need for our industry to become a sustainable industry so that we can continue to fly. And that goes back to my previous comment about how essential aviation is for economic development. So if we do believe that aviation is essential for economic development, then we have to make sure that we can fly without emitting so much CO2 and arguably other stuff. And here I really feel like the world hasn't really made up its mind about this, which is mind-boggling. It's like, how can we make people, wake up to this intimate connection between our future, present and future welfare and the preservation of connectivity and then in particular aviation connectivity. So we have Europe, for instance, speaking about travel. Not travel bans, but bans on short-haul flights, right? So that's an absolutely crazy outlier strategy for dealing with decarbonization, yeah, to reduce options and choice for consumers. Yeah, that's very anti sort of the best terms of liberal economics that have, after all, been so fruitful for so many people during the 20th century. So I think where I can go with this conversation, and in terms of long-term trends and big influences, where I would go with this is that we are definitely seeing an increase in industrial policy, as we call it, which is a nice word for state intervention in the private sector. Again, I'm Swedish, right? So my model for this is a free market coupled with strong social safeguards and support systems, right? So I am not, necessarily the complete animal style capitalism at all cost, but I do believe in free markets coupled with strong social support systems, and that means that I have no room for governments choosing by which means of transportation people are supposed to move around. That's a completely different economic philosophy, and I object to that one strongly, and I'm perturbed to see that across the board and across sectors, we now find ourselves in this trend towards more industrial policy, more inward-looking economic policies, more transactional economic behavior, tit for tat, if you wish, less obviously openness and systemic thinking. And this is comes really at a very bad time, because this is a time where we need more openness, more collaboration, and more systemic thinking. So that's my biggest problem, I would say, in today's world economy.
Well, let's just stick with that topic of sustainability, Marie, because as you said, I mean, it's critical that the industry, theoretically at least, gets its house in order, and that in itself is a big challenge. But it does seem to me there's a massive dichotomy in that we, again, to echo what I mentioned, we're here in Europe, but we've been listened to by people around the world, that we maybe seem to have a twin track approach or dichotomy between, say, what the US and Europe is doing while the rest of the world is getting on doing other things. And we're going to touch on it in a number of ways. But in Europe, we're looking to fetter the industry. But if we look at growing economies, for example, in the Middle East, in Asia, it seems to me Europe could shut down, the US could shut down, and still the rest of the world would go on. But pollution is an issue, and the emissions, of course, is a basic issue. But we just seem to be in a terrible tangle about the way forward on all this. The IATA, which you're speaking for, is doing its best to push in terms of improving the industry's credentials.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it really is important that we make up our minds about what the role of the state is, and then if we agree on that, then what priorities that state should have. So, in my mind, the role of the state is to enable and protect, not make difficult and then maybe protect. So enable and protect, and then if we all agree that that is what we're supposed to do, then the agenda becomes clear, right? Then obviously states should enable aviation to continue, and that must involve this transition to net zero, of course, not only for aviation but for the economy and global economy as a whole. Yeah, the big thing for all of us is to wean ourselves of our addiction to fossil fuels. So that's really the issue. Yeah. And aviation is just a small part of that issue, but a really important one, given how much we contribute to economic development, right? So as long as we're dithering about these things, yeah, and we can't quite make up our minds about what our priorities are, then we will not succeed. Yeah. In Europe or elsewhere. It's and I think that's a problem we have now.
I mean, I think that's a key point, isn't it? The visibility of aviation is great, whether it's people living near airports and they hear the noise of departing and arriving aircraft, or people looking up in the sky, especially on a bright day, and seeing vapor contrails and getting very exercised about the contribution to the climate change challenge and emissions overall that it actually does. But it's disproportionate, as you say, to the impact that aviation produces positively. And we don't seem to be getting a proper engagement, certainly not at a global level. Maybe that's a vain hope, I don't know, to get politicians to debate this sensibly and balance it out. And indeed, as you said, to commit resources, not to interfere, but to help when the private market doesn't, or more likely cannot provide, put some framework in place to ensure there's the necessary investment, so that we can expedite this improvement.
Exactly. And it maybe this is too much philosophy, but I also think that another problem we have is that we're all too siloed. So in our industry, obviously there's a complete commitment and unanimity about what we're supposed to do. So IATA committed to becoming to bring aviation to a sustainable situation in terms of emissions. I'm struggling with net zero, given that soon we're not going to be allowed to say net zero, right? But I guess we're not there yet. So net zero in 2050 is what IATA committed to in 2021. ICAO, our UN sister organization, committed to the same in 2022. And I think there's just no other industry, to my knowledge. Please fact check me and send me an email if I'm wrong. But I think we're the only industry who has this kind of complete united commitment from the airlines and from the member states under ICAO. But ICAO only governs aviation. So obviously that is not the energy people nor the people with the money. So it's just sort of not enough when we're facing a systemic crisis of this sort. So that's the problem. And, for 70, 80 years almost, aviation managed its issues really super well with these two sister organizations working hand in hand for all this time, ever since the birth of civil aviation. And it's now, of course, the most safe and best performing mode of transportation in the world, right? So that's amazing. And they could do that without sort of much having to worry about other systemic issues. But today the world has changed. Today we have to worry about the world around us and how this all fits in with all the other bits. And that's where I come back to the idea that if we don't have a single-minded, united commitment to realizing this energy transition, it's just simply not something that IATA and ICAO and the airlines can do on their own. We can be 100% committed. We just can't do it on our own. And we have to somehow get the world to be able to think more systemically, which is a huge challenge because our organizations are not set up in that way, and our brains are arguably not even equipped very well for those types of holistic challenges.
The challenge behind all of this is technology. Do you, especially thinking of coming from outside the sector, have any hope that if there was more investment, we could actually speed that technology? So we're not talking about more than 50 years from now, we won't have long-haul aircraft that can fly by another means, say electric or hydrogen.
100%. And this is the crazy stuff, that okay, we can debate how much money we need for our transition, somewhere between 3 and 5 trillion, we can make sure that aviation is sustainable by 2050. And so that's obviously a large variance, I admit. But okay, and it also sounds like a terrifyingly large number. But it's only a fraction of the money that goes into fossil fuel development and production today. So if we break our needs up on an annualized basis and we take the top figure, we're looking at 5 trillion, say, then we just need a third of the money that already goes into that currently is invested into oil and gas development on an annual basis. So 1/3 of their money would take care of our investment needs. And also, the money that the governments spend on subsidizing fossil fuel exploration and production would, in turn, if we could redirect those subsidies to, SAF, say, sustainable aviation fuels or solutions for our industry, then that would pay for 1/3 of our needs, right? We are engaged with governments to, at every level involved with them, with the other stakeholders in the world about how we can standardize and various certifications of these fuels, get more pathways approved, pathways being the different types of feedstocks that inputs that you can use for making these sustainable aviation fuels, and just sort of building maybe some kind of matchmaking platforms, right, where energy producers, governments, airlines, and other relevant persons can find each other, and we can help advance actual physical projects. So these are just a handful of the things that we are trying to do. So we feel like we're sitting on a boiling cauldron, sort of, and it's a very effervescent and sort of startup-minded space we're all in. It is very stimulating, but it's also very challenging because there's all that still to be done.
I think challenge is really an understatement, isn't it, Marie? I mean, if we look at governments who are taking very different approaches to this, as you mentioned, we're at a very tiny percentage of availability of these new sustainable fuels to what is required to meet the industry's objectives to become carbon neutral. And we have some governments taking a relatively carrot-like approach and incentivizing production. Certainly, the US has been pretty well commended for doing that, while in Europe, for example, there's been more of a stick approach. And of course, this is going to lead to increased costs for the sector as well, isn't it? Not just the investment in getting the production, but the price of those fuels is going to be higher. Ultimately, I guess that's going to feed through to ticket prices in the medium to long term.
Yeah, you have to assume, right? Because that's obviously necessary for a business to cover its costs. Yeah, that's what businesses must do, otherwise they fail. And our margins are today, our net margins are in the vicinity of 2.5%, 2.7%, or something like $5 per passenger. Yeah, so that's sort of the price of a coffee in London or Geneva. Yeah. So that
Amazing.
so with those types of slim margins, clearly something is going to have to end up impacting the ticket price at some point. I think that's a very safe assumption. But by the same token, the faster we can get up these volumes and operate at scale, arguably the lower the price and the lower the impact on the consumer. So that's also another reason why we feel such a great sense of urgency with all of this. The faster we can do this, not only will it be better for the planet, but it will be better for the consumers and better for the airlines and the airports and everybody else. So it's a huge win-win-win-win scenario here if we can all just make up our minds and that we actually need to do this. So there's an issue about the cost effectiveness of the associated policies, right? And I just really wish that governments would engage more in evidence-based policy making, because clearly, these short-haul bans have virtually no visible impact on emissions, right? But they obviously create huge disruptions and worse service for the customers. So that is, I think, both Schiphol and the French ban on short-haul flights are stark examples of clearly not cost-effective policies. Cost-effective meaning, what is the cost I'm paying for this unit of decarbonization, right? Those relationships are completely out of whack on those types of policies.
I think we just do a podcast on this whole sustainability issue, but I'm just going to move us away from it now, just on some of the other issues. And I'm sure it's going to lap in as we go along. And I'm really wondering about this question. We see very different developments of population according to which part of the world we're in, particularly in Europe and the US. We're seeing more of an aging population in countries such as Japan, even areas of growth that we think about, such as China. There's talk some decades down the line, admittedly, but of peak population. Africa has a particularly young skewing of its population. Give us some of your thinking about what that means as drivers for levels of demand and the type of travel that we're going to see in the decades ahead, as far as airlines are concerned.
Right. So first, as an economist, obviously we like having access to lots of people because they work and they help us grow our economies. So the fact that population growth will peak, yeah, at some point, and now most people think that it might peak a little bit earlier than what they previously thought, and maybe at a lower level. Right. So we're sort of moving from thinking 10, 11 billion people in 2100 to thinking maybe 9 billion might be the peak, and maybe indeed somewhere around 2050 or shortly thereafter. So this sort of fundamentally spells some kind of threat of lack of working people in the economy. And of course, we know that there's a bunch of countries who are more affected by this than others. And of course, this wouldn't necessarily be a problem if it weren't so politically fraught, because there's clearly enough people on Earth. Yeah. And if some people are lacking working age population over here, they could, usefully promote migration. That's, one very thorny issue. We know not only in the US, but for Europe and almost every country has sort of become less open to migration. So we're shooting ourselves in the foot on that one. Yeah, we can see the problem coming, but we're not liking the solution. And if we don't like migration, what do we do about shrinking populations? Well, we can work longer hours. Not popular. We can become more productive. Okay, here we might start to think that there might be things that we can do, because maybe thanks to technology and artificial intelligence and all of those things, maybe it's possible to be as productive in the future, even if the population is at some point smaller. So what it really does for me is say that, the probability that we're going to have an increase in our potential growth rate in the future is low. Yeah. And that again comes at a very unfortunate point in time, because we're just now needing, more growth to tackle climate change and all of these other issues. And for the airline industry, growth, GDP growth, and population growth is, one of the most influential factors in terms of driving traffic demand, both on the cargo and on the passenger side. Obviously, on the cargo side, there's also how do these people trade with each other, right? So trade is a very important explanatory factor also for the cargo demand. So that's sort of structurally not super great, yeah, if we look over long periods. I'm talking now, yeah, this century, put it that way, right? So the fundamentals are turning a lot less supportive than they were in the 20th century. The 21st century is not as favorable. Many of these sort of structural factors influencing our industry and the global economy are, at the very least, they're becoming less supportive. Yeah. And in some cases, maybe even outright detrimental. Now, so obviously the answer lies in how we deal with these problems and human ingenuity and all of these things, innovation, AI. Maybe we will find solutions to this. And as long as we can find some solutions to this and the world economy can still grow, then our industry can still grow. If there's money to pay for the tickets and to buy the goods and to ship the goods, then it's not necessarily a curse for us to be a shrinking industry because the population is shrinking. But it certainly makes it more challenging. And if we manage to have growth and growth in income, then we can expand our activity amongst the shrinking population, right? Grab a bigger share of this shrinking population. And that is obviously what we need to prevent those who will still be around from having worse economic outcomes, yeah.
Just as you talk there, Maria, I mean, it's just incredibly complicated, isn't it? These trends going forward, because I was reflecting that we came out of COVID, and even as the industry was trying to pick itself up during the COVID pandemic, the strongest flows of traffic were, first of all, VFR, as the industry calls it, visiting friends and relations. And that reflects partly into what you described about migration flows. There's always been big worker flows, let's say from Indian subcontinent to the Gulf, from Mexico, Latin America to North America, from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, and many others. And people wanted to visit their friends and family. The needs of economies to bring labor in from other places because of lack of manpower. That's been a major flow of traffic. Also, typically quite a price sensitive flow of traffic. Aging population is another where we see many people took early retirement out of COVID in countries like the US, and they've got plenty of money in the bank, and they're going off on this what was called revenge travel. It seems to be carrying on beyond that. So there's a lot going on there. But I was just thinking alongside that, as well as the issue of population itself, there are changes in wealth and even polarization of wealth. We seem to be getting the super rich get richer, while many others don't have money to put food on the table. So the price sensitive travel, which is going along with that VFR flow that I mentioned, is maybe under threat. It's hard to pick our way through this, isn't it, to work out which way it's going to go in volumes and kind of traffic for the industry.
Yeah, exactly, because you can have many of these things happening simultaneously. You can have, you know, a worsening income distribution, but still, you know, the average level of income in the country rising, yeah? And then we need to plug in, you know, how many, what's the population growth? So maybe our segment of that population could still be growing, yeah? Even if these other problems, you know, threaten our activity in exactly the way you say. And I think that's sort of basically where I'm at for at least the foreseeable future. That, okay, we can see these threats, but I still believe that there are sufficient gains in absolute incomes to offset whatever we might be losing in certain segments. So simply put, because of China and India, yeah,
yes.
More people in China and India are going to earn better incomes, even if we have all of these negative things going on at the same time. And then there's a numbers game, so which I think plays to our industry's favor. You know, we don't collect data, for instance, on purpose of travel. Yes, we don't know necessarily why they travel, but we do collect data on in which cabin class they travel. And here we have seen since the pandemic, the same expansion of both what we call premium, yeah, so first and business, and then economy is everything else. And they have been growing at the same pace, the two of them. So indeed, maybe some business travelers are not traveling, but if so, they are being replaced by these other people coming into being able to travel. So for now, I think that the trend is definitely positive, I would argue, and certainly until we do get closer to this peak population and so on, unless the next crisis comes, you know, which of course that can always happen.
And as you said, you know, China, India, they have large populations. The growth particularly talked about the middle class in India. We see it even in the blossoming of airlines in those countries, and not just within the countries, but from
those
countries, this hunger to travel, particularly the young generation. We've talked with African leaders in the series about, one, the necessity of air travel on the size of that continent, but many young people in Africa having to move significant distances and from one country to another for work, but also because they want to, and where people have money in the pocket, particularly young generations, they want to travel and explore, which to me I find a positive thing. But that brings me into thinking about another conflict, which you have talked about a lot in the immediate term, and we're not focused on the immediate term, but it is a big change that this year you've quoted, of course, in the art of the largest number of elections we've ever seen, affecting something like 70% of the population. We've seen big political turmoil in recent years. So, and a closing down, we've touched on the issue of migration, more inward looking. How might we square this? I'm really asking you to look at your own crystal ball, because I certainly don't have the answer. There is this desire, young people who are future, want to travel, are traveling while they have a chance, yet political systems in some ways are risking inhibiting it through either inward looking or the whole challenge we've debated or discussed of sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, so I think it's about 70 countries and certainly a majority of the world population. I think 4.3 billion people will vote. And this is a first in history that we have so many votes, which, you know, on the one hand, you could think, oh, that's fantastic, you know, maybe democracy is spreading. But no, not so fast, because obviously we don't know necessarily the outcome of these elections. And there's, you know, reasons to fear that there will be a shift rather towards the right, or in any case, that whatever we think about our own preferred policies, that there will be big policy shifts, yeah, depending on the outcome of these elections. And that's always unfriendly, sort of, to business in general, yeah, that there are starts and stops, sort of, in our government's policy stances. So I think that's a big threat. And if we put it, in terms of really long-term trends and talk about centuries, I feel compelled to say that the 20th century was obviously the best century on record. Yeah, that was absolutely amazing, driven in large part by innovation in transportation and falling costs of transportation, and by the spread of the use of fossil energies. And now we have this current century, which I think is going to be indeed mired by all of these, of a lot of volatility and much more complicated general environment. And the best period, obviously, in the last century was the after-war period. And again, that was when civil aviation, global civil aviation, was invented by these people who really had the imagination to understand that in order to make a better world, we need to connect people. Yeah, we need to allow people to meet each other and do things together, and we need to collaborate. And they really saw this sector that they created, they had the vision to see that this is a sector that can promote peace and economic development for everybody. And that's indeed what happened in the 20th century, longest period of peace, right? Now we already have two wars, amongst other armed conflicts, to contend with. And yeah, this is going to be a much more complicated century. Now, I still believe, indeed, as you say, in our own surveys of passengers and so on, clearly show that people still want to travel. People do want to be connected. Most people do indeed grasp these notions, yeah, of what aviation can do for the world in terms of, again, economic development and connecting people and promoting peace and so on. So I'm not so worried about the young people and what they want. I'm much more worried about the governments and what they might do.
Yeah, certainly that's the biggest unknown, I guess, within human control in the decades ahead. Just again, you touched on another aspect of the future already there. We're seeing massive technological developments now in the 21st century, and AI is the term which is on everybody's tongue these days. Some fearful, some seeing it as an opportunity. As an economist, how do you look at that? Because undoubtedly, including our own industry, it allows amazing number of things to be done that couldn't be done in the past, all with the same scale or the same reliability. On the other, there could be fear about will it be negative from a point of view of employment and working conditions. But equally, could it be positive? Are people going to have more leisure time? Brings back the question about income distribution and so on. What's your reflections on that as an input to aviation's future?
Yeah, I think indeed in these long-term evolutions, your question makes me want to stress as well that another long-term trend that we all have to contend with is the speed of change. Yeah, so things are definitely changing faster and ever faster. And I think AI is obviously one of these areas where many of us will completely struggle to including governments, yeah, to even grasp, what the cons. I don't think we have, anywhere near the imagination today to really assess what this is going to do to us all. So that's sort of problematic, I believe, because obviously that risks lagging regulation, which is already a problem, yeah, that regulation lags, and it's just going to continue to lag probably, and it might be inappropriate. And so it's going to be more and more challenging for us all to adapt to all of these new technologies that are coming at breakneck speed. And of course, any technological change, as far as we have experienced this in economic history, yeah, brings this kind of, what Schumpeter called the creative destruction to us all, meaning that jobs disappear and then new jobs are created. It wasn't that long ago that podcasts didn't exist, right? But now we do
That's true.
podcasts. Yeah. So, So people will obviously engage in new activities, but there will always be a group of people who will be in the middle of this churn and will struggle to find, gainful employment or improve their economic and general welfare. So that's where I come back to the Swedish economic model. Yeah, I think we can embrace technology in general. It's of course great if regulation can keep up with it and protect us from its worst instincts, and then if we also can protect those who somehow fall into the cracks, then I think indeed that this has the capacity to overcome some of those other structural problems that we have, including the peaking population and the other structural impediments to growth that we face. Yeah, so definitely, I'm putting sort of a very large portion of my hopes into rapid technological change, although, as we've now just said, that comes with its own sets of risks and it needs to be managed. Yeah.
And certainly the industry is in its infancy of using what is available in terms of not just AI, but big data. And big data has been around some time now, but I'm fascinated myself when I think that in my earlier airline career, doing analysis on things like network planning, we were always looking at the past. But now we can look at the present and to an extent the future because big data allows us to do it. The airline industry is understanding more about its customers. We see where people are searching for flights, people are looking at certain price ranges, helping the industry to plan ahead. We have aircraft that are able to communicate directly with the ground about defects before they even arrive, so they can be ready with spare parts to fix them. So there's a fascinating and positive side there, I guess.
Yeah, but we still need to connect with an equally positive mindset if such a thing were possible. Yeah, and I think that's where things are not looking so great. That there's a decrease in collaboration in general, certainly between countries, and very hard to bring about international agreements, right? And actually see people live up to them. And similarly, I would say that sort of that this is happens in industries as well. Yeah, that for many reasons that industries might not want to collaborate with other, I mean, sectors, maybe I should say, yeah, that sectors don't, various parts of the value chain in a sector might not want to share and collaborate with other parts in that value chain, yeah, for a number of reasons. Whereas if we could, and of course, aviation is special, we think in general, but it's also special in this respect, yeah, that the gains, would be so phenomenal if we can get global collaboration in our sector. And, if we could have the air traffic controllers and the airports and the airlines actually working together, to improve the passenger experience, that would be amazing. I think that there's just so much that could be done thanks to the data that we all have, but that we don't necessarily share with each other. So that problem, I think, is amplifying as a general trend and exists at every level in our economies.
And it certainly is, it's counterintuitive. I mean, to an extent, just reflecting as you were speaking there, Marie, the pandemic, I must admit, maybe I rather idealistically b believed that was something that it was humanity against a pandemic. We did okay, and we've got through the worst of that pandemic, but we also showed we were in many ways incapable to cooperate. We didn't do as much as we could. IATA again led the way there to try to simplify documentation and testing and so on. So I think we've probably got a lot more to learn as a species to try to get back that way. Yet we're in this global industry that links people, where, as we discussed, young people in particular, they want the joy of traveling. We want to meet people from different countries and cultures, and not just from a leisure point of view, but to trade with them as well.
Yes, and work in different places, and migrate and help everybody do better. It's not just. I mean, let's not underestimate the importance of tourism in the various economies around the world. Yeah, so of course, tourism is. Many countries depend on it for their economic growth. So, wanting to go on holiday is a really important thing for many economies, but. but it goes beyond that. Yeah, so I sort of objected to nothing that you said, of course, but it makes me think of the idea that many people have that this is somehow frivolous, right? I don't know, sort of what where you have been, you know, for the past, certainly since COVID, you know, people who lived through COVID and saw that recession and the millions of people unemployed and all the airlines grounded, and then they think that we can somehow do without aviation. Not on, I'm not saying that that's the only thing we can't do without. It's obviously one of many, but you know, clearly the impact of not having access to that should have people forgotten that? That's I don't really understand how it can't be obvious to us all the detriment that that would do to us all individually into the world economy if we curtail this, right?
Well, I think that particular issue puts it into sharp focus. You know, countries, whether they are island economies or not, you know, that rely, as you said, increasingly on tourism, where jobs have been created, livelihoods have been fostered, because aviation is the only means to bring people as visitors to and from those countries. And yes, that needs to be managed in the context, another topic in its own right, not for today, of over tourism and what we've touched on already with
Agreed.
sustainability. But this is the 21st century. We want to travel around our globe and enjoy it. And I think it's interesting as well, if we look at aviation's development right now, if we look at order books for aircraft in the years ahead, we're seeing some massive shifts there, which perhaps reflect what's happening in geopolitics. Saudi Arabia opening up, no longer prepared to accept being an oil-based economy, really looking for tourism. Vision 2030, hundreds of aircraft on order, talking about getting more air services into that country, showing what they have to offer culturally as well as trade. China, of course, and India, we've talked about the desire there. But those are examples of a recognition of the value of aviation. Still, the latent potential of Africa, which is not yet coming through. It's massively underserved and people are hungry for travel.
Absolutely. And obviously the oil producing countries in the Middle East, they understand that they are not, you know, probably it depends on what happens during all of these elections and afterwards. But in principle, the world is more or less committed to weaning itself off of fossil fuel, and therefore those economies need to find other areas in which they can generate economic growth for themselves. And here we see again, yeah, that obviously the role that aviation will play in any such endeavor. So there's one problem, obviously, that airlines have always faced ever in recent history, maybe I should say, and that is the fact that it is so exposed to the global trends and the global business cycle, and sort of basically any crisis that happens is going to have an impact on aviation. And I think, you know, arguably even in to a greater extent than what I experienced in the financial sector. So very agitated sector, very vulnerable to all of these external impacts, and therefore a sector that struggles to be sustainably profitable. Yeah, and of course, COVID was, you know, the mother of all shocks, right? With where airlines lost $140 billion in 2020, and now the airlines have returned to profitability, which is in it of itself absolutely amazing. Yeah, that to do that in the space of so few years. So I think that really shows how resilient our industry is. Yeah, it's like a bit of a whack-a-mole industry, right? It gets hit repeatedly but always bounces back, and that's fantastic. But what I wish for the industry is that maybe it could build more robustness, yeah, so that when it gets these hits, it might actually be able to withstand that shock better and perhaps not fall over sort of every time, right? And
Well, that was something I wanted to put to you, Marie, because you know, we did see coming out of COVID, it was in many ways quite shocking, of course, to airlines around the world that are not well run and not robust in terms of financial resources. I think there was a feeling that certainly for a number of European carriers, not least the large low-cost carriers, a number of the airlines in the US were in a very robust financial position. Yet COVID hit, and of course, cash was bleeding out of the airline's coffers in millions of whatever currency unit you would choose to pick every day. And airlines went, some of them, asking governments to help them out. And yet there'd been this confidence in some airline management that, oh, we're never going to face cyclical challenges again. We're giving big dividends to our shareholders. But when the chips were down, they had to go back. So that was exactly what I wanted to ask you about. Would you be
Oh,
optimistic the industry can learn from this and not repeat that and get into a robust state for the future?
yeah. So I think there's a lot of, a lot of things to think about here, because, and looking at aviation throughout its history and how it has evolved, So part of me wants to say that airlines have sort of outsourced most of the profit-making areas, right, to other parts of the value chain, and sort of n now they're left with the bits that are less profit-making, obviously. So, and also the unique nature of our value chain, right? That upstream, it is mostly sort of monopolistic or oligopolistic entities. Yeah, we do only have two aircraft manufacturers. Airports, of course, we can discuss, but basically they are some kind of natural monopoly after all, and only a few ticket distributors, which the airlines used to own, by the way, right? And now they have this oligopolistic situation. So upstream airlines don't have any means to influence much the prices that those guys are going to charge the airlines, right? So airlines are price takers upstream, and then downstream, there's this absolutely crazy competitive environment, which also I don't think exists anywhere else, right? That people can actually go online and find everybody's ticket price on every flight, everywhere, all the time. In financial markets, we obviously have something that looks a bit like that, but it's B2B. Yeah, so no bank would ever show those screens to the customers. Let's be clear. Yeah. So that is just an absolutely intense competitive environment, which obviously forces airlines to compete on price. So they're sort of squeezed between, not being able to eke out or influence much the price they charge the customers, and not be able to influence much the price for all the upstream services that airlines need. And the biggest one of those is, of course, fuel. Yeah, 30% of airlines' cost is fuel. So how do we change this? I think we really need to think about, and of course airlines are, thinking about that on a daily basis, and many are doing all kinds of creative stuff. But if I just look at the industry as a whole, I and my wish for the industry, it would perhaps be like, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could insource our fuel supply? And maybe this is the opportunity to do that, given that we are all engaged, hopefully, in this energy transition.
Well, maybe Marie, that's a good point on which to draw to a close. I could certainly ask you many more questions, but I think we have to call it a day for this particular podcast. So it's been a real pleasure talking to you today to hear your broader economic insights and your reflections coming quite recently to aviation. So Marie Owens-Thompson, Senior Vice President, Sustainability and Chief Economist at IATA, thank you very much indeed.
I'm very grateful. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to you for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of Our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. But for now, from me, John Strickland, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by our speakers are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, or delays in this information, or any losses, injuries, or damages arising from its use.